Hi, Sherry. This is Cheryl with Home Cures at Work and Barton Publishing. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Cheryl. Thank
Great.
you.
Yeah, great to have you today. You are Sherry Strong, and we're going to interview today about GMOs. But first, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, where they can find you on the web, and what you do?
Okay. My background's as a chef and nutritionist, and then I had been living in Australia for 22 years. I went there on a working holiday in 1989 and became a chef, and then opened a cooking school called the Food Lovers Workshop in 1993, which oddly enough led me to becoming the Victorian Chair of Nutrition Australia, the Melbourne President of Slow Food, the curator and co-founder of the World Wellness Project, and I was on numerous television shows and glossy magazines and on numerous boards over the years. And I came back to Canada a year and a half ago to start a holistic entrepreneurship program teaching holistic practitioners how to speak powerfully, cook holistically, as many of them don't know how to cook holistically, and to make money authentically. And so my background really over the last 10 years has really been as a speaker, and educator in the area of health and wellness.
Well, what do you love to cook?
Oh my goodness, real food is the big thing for me. I don't put myself into any kind of foodist category as a raw foodist or vegan or vegetarian or anything like that. I like food that we'd find very close to nature, and I like to play with that. So, and my websites, you can find my stuff, television interviews on sherrystrong.com, and my work in my classes, and what I teach at jivala.com, which is JIIVALA.com.
And great. And you even spoke at a TED conference.
I did. I went to TED in the last year. It was in Monterey, and the organizer of TEDx Tokyo invited me to speak in Tokyo, which was pretty exciting. And I think that video collectively has had about 10,000 hits. So it was a really exciting thing for me.
Yeah, and with that many views, you must be saying something right.
I think, the difference about my approach, Cheryl, is that I'm a food philosopher. So I really talk about food in a philosophical viewpoint, and really making nature kind of the basis, the grounding force. And I believe that nature is infinitely smarter than us. And the smartest thing that we can do is really work with nature, figure out how to best work with nature, rather than trying to reinvent nature. Because my experience has been, and my study has been over the many years that I've spoke to experts in all areas around food and health around the world, is that when we push the boundaries of nature, something's got to give, and that they're infinitely more intelligent, intelligences in nature than I think the human body can, or the human mind can, fully comprehend right now. And when we work more intuitively, that we actually, it's a lot easier to figure out what to eat rather than just working on our head and science.
Well, I know when you start using something that's not intended for, you start getting problems. And so when we start masking foods, we start getting problems and they're not necessary.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you talk about on your website about food justice and slow eating. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the slow food movement, I was involved with the slow food movement because I really liked the idea of going back to kind of a slower approach to eating food rather than the fast food drive-through mentality. Because the problem with the fast food drive-through mentality is not just that it impacts our health. It actually impacts the health of the people right from the beginning, who actually grow the food, to packaging and processing that food, to the environment and all other the species that are actually impacted by it. Because one of the universal axioms that I use is that when it comes to food, it applies to many other things, but particularly when it comes to food, when money is the bottom line, everything else is compromised. And so getting clean and good and organic and fair, fairly raised food for everyone on the planet is, it's not just the concern of, a few individuals. It should be of concern to all of us. And Although I'm not a religious person, at one time I did study to become a missionary, and there's some words that resonate with me that Jesus said. He said, "What you do to the least of me, you do to me." And I don't know if he intended it as an environmental message, but what I have come to learn is that what we do to the very minor, microscopic, you know, microorganism on the planet, we actually end up doing to us, and, you know, can actually impact not only ourselves today environmentally and how we, you know, we affect these foods and then we eat them, but it can actually affect many generations from now. And one of the things I really loved about a phrase that, her name's escaped me, she was the woman, Jane Goodall, mm-hmm. had said about, she said, "For all our intelligence as humans, we seem to have forgotten the wisdom of Aboriginal and, you know, Indigenous cultures." And she said, and by that, what I mean by that is that every decision that they made was not just based on how this would impact them, but actually impact seven generations from that viewpoint, from that decision.
Yeah.
And I think today that what's happened to our food world is that we've made very temporary decisions based on very temporary outcomes, and most of that has been financially instigated. And so food justice, slow food, can have different meanings to different people, but for me, it really, the solution around it really just comes back to, I'm writing a book called Return to Food, How Going Back is the Way Forward, and I really think the essence of all of that is just us returning to eat real food.
So that involves planting a garden or buying foods from the farmer's market or eating it in the simplest way possible?
Yes. Yeah, so if you think of the acronym, a Professor Mark Cohen in Australia, he came up with the acronym for seasonal, local, organic, and whole. And I love that. You know, I think that if you use that as your basis, you can't go wrong.
That's great. I'm going to write that down. We'll put that up. Seasonal, local, organic, and whole.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, let's turn our thoughts to GMOs. And I wanted mm-hmm. to ask you if you have a GMO experience you could relate to. One of our doctors who writes for us actually recorded on video the difference in his son and his hyperactivity when he ate GMO corn versus non-GMO corn. And when he ate GMO corn, he was super hyper. And his wife noticed first, he didn't believe it. And then when they videotaped it, sure enough, there was a clear difference. So do you have any personal experience you would relate to eating GMO foods?
So my experience with the GMO products is probably more around when I first started coming back after living in Australia, where they have less products on the shelf with genetically modified foods in them. I would come back to Canada and I would just kind of notice that I would make the same recipes that I would make in Australia and they would taste different here in Canada. And when I moved back to Canada, what I found was that I really noticed a huge difference in how I felt when I ate the food here. And even in places where I thought I was getting really good quality food, I noticed that, you know, I would actually experience much more bloating and gas, and foods that I could eat in Australia I couldn't actually eat here. And when I started to do, you know, started to actually look at those foods and do the research, I realized that they were all potentially things that could have GMO products in them. Now, to be quite honest, it can also be the hybridization of the foods. But in each case, it's about all the foods that are actually taken steps away from nature. Mm-hmm. And what I've observed is the foods that I had that were further steps away from nature, the more ill that I felt.
I wish people could can make those connections more often when they eat.
Well, I think, too, that, you know, unless you're looking for it, sometimes you just get so busy, you don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you actually have to be still and become a scientist. You know, you actually have to start to make those powerful observations as to what is, you know, what's actually happening with your body.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you actually have that time and stillness and you're actually conscious and aware to make those distinguishing factors, because sometimes you can eat a food in the morning and it may not actually impact you until the next day. It's not always, you know, an immediate effect, and so you have to notice commonalities between, well, when I have this food at this certain time, it's always, you know, maybe 10 hours or 8 hours or 20, even 24 hours later, I experience this result. And that can even show up just, you know, in your stools, for lack of a better word, you know, around all of those things. Your body's constantly communicating to you, and it actually knows what is best for you. But we do have to actually give some time and patience to really understand what it is that's actually happening with our body.
What would you look for then as sign of your body reacting to GMOs? You had the privilege of eating probably pretty clean and then coming to America or Canada and noticing the change. But for someone who's eaten, you know, food from the shelves that have had GMO on their list of ingredients, what are things that would make them realize this is affecting my body? What are the symptoms?
Well, you know, the list can be quite varied. And you, the problem is that the full effects of GMO foods on the human body, there haven't been proper studies to actually show exactly the ramifications. So what I do notice are certain things like brain fog, bloating, nausea. You can actually get any kind of irritation within the gut, because obviously that food is primarily first going into your gut. Mm-hmm. And Hippocrates said that all disease begins in the gut. Right. So anything related to that will actually be an indicator. But it can also, in all fairness, it can also be an indicator of just the highly processed diet. The problem is that, as we know now, 85% of our food stuff in the supermarket can contain some GMO ingredients. So it's hard to know, is it the GMO ingredient or is it just the fact that it's just so hybridized and overly processed?
So how would you describe the difference between hybridized and GMO?
Okay, so hybridized is where someone can actually do this, where they just mix two seeds together, you know, on a farm. You can actually do that. Genetic modification could never actually happen on a farm without a serious laboratory. So you could never accidentally genetically modify something in nature. And some people might like to play with those words, but genetic modification can never ever happen in a natural environment. It's something that could only happen through years of study and research and science of actually how to blend these technologies, and through elaborate equipment that can make that happen.
Through scientific manipulation, basically.
Absolutely.
So yeah. Hybrid, let's say if you're planting a garden, you want hybrid seeds. Are those safe to plant?
Yes, well, I mean, and the interesting thing is it just goes to show you that, you know, that whole thing around the wisdom of nature is they're showing consistently that there's less nutrition in hybridized seeds, so and plants, but there isn't the information to say that they're harmful, and that's the difference. All the studies, you know, that they've had that have been independently done, are definitely showing that there is harm in these. So, and two of the best books that I've seen that document this are Genetic Roulette and Seeds of Deception, both by Jeffrey Smith. So it's there's some serious illnesses that are connected to it, including, you know, inflammation, immune dysfunction. They're even connecting things like sterility, infant mortality, all kinds of allergies, organ defects, to the genetic modification of our food. So there, and Jeffrey Smith says there's at least 65 health risks associated with it, and he's probably one of the people in the world who has done the most extensive research, and in my opinion, from what I've looked, kind of the most credible research. I interviewed him in Australia many years ago, and highly recommend his books.
Yes, he is a known expert.
Yes. And I think, too, the other thing that he exposes, which I think is really important, is he really exposes how secretive and deceptive corporations have been around the genetic modification of our food, and how they've basically been very deceptive in getting the the technology and the food into our food system and made legal, the whole thing around that has been pretty nasty. And the safety factor, you know, people who've had vested interests in the actual technology, both financially and from an employment viewpoint, have been on the FDA making decisions about that being acceptable, accepted into our food system. And a lot of things have actually been covered up. And I think probably the bottom line for me, particularly because there was so much propaganda from the biotech companies about how they were wanting to feed the hungry, and they really made it about that, is if you start to do the research and you hear people like Vandana Shiva, who's an Indian advocate of natural foods and is against genetic modification of foods, you see just how destructive it has been environmentally and to the whole social structure of Indian farming, and it's super sad. All these companies are, you know, they're chemical companies, you know, they're pharmaceutical companies who heavily invest in biotech. These are not companies that are interested in feeding the world and taking care of the more vulnerable in our communities. They are companies that have money as their bottom line, and as I mentioned before, when money is the bottom line, everything is compromised.
So scary.
Well, it is scary, and I think when we don't take our own power, it becomes scary. And I think the antidote to that is to actually starting to realize that we actually have a lot more power than we know. And it becomes kind of cliche now, but our power is in our food dollar. How we spend our money is a very, very powerful message to food companies. And it's interesting because I've been on panels and I've spoken to people within government. And when I was the Victorian Chair of Nutrition Australia, we actually facilitated an education evening as part of their sponsorship through Nutrition Australia. And they're very reasonable people, and they're very lovely people. And you can kind of be lulled into thinking, well, it can't be all that bad. But the truth is that there's a lot of money involved in this. And when consumers say consistently, you know what, I'm not going to pay for that, I'm actually refusing to get that because I don't know how that's grown, and I don't trust that it's being grown properly, we have the ability to actually change how things are happening.
And as word gets out, more people will make decisions with their money and how to be convincing to these big organizations and to the local farmers. Let me ask you another question. How, from your point of view as a food philosopher, maybe you've already answered this question, but how has the introduction of GM foods actually changed the fabric of eating in America?
Well, there's an intuitive intelligence in food that's built in, you know, to the food, and it actually, food can nourish, energize, and protect us. And when we start to play with it, it changes the actual messages it gives in the body. And since we started genetically modifying our food, we've, you know, doing things particularly to create things like high fructose corn syrup, which is a result of, you know, in part of genetic modification. When we start to change it on that level, we change the way the body actually responds to foods. And some things the body will just immediately eliminate. And it sounds like the worst thing that can happen, but it's actually body's protective mechanism. So it's good when the body's quickly eliminating these foods, either through, you know, diarrhea or vomiting. But I think what's worse is when the body has no idea what to do with those foods, and they actually get stored in the body or expressed in disease in the body. And we're seeing bizarre things like Morgellons disease, where they have these blue or green wiry type substances that actually poke out of the skin. They're quite itchy. And when they pull them out, they actually feel like wire. Wow. And they contain genetically modified DNA in there. So there's many, many different ways that it's being expressed.
So this how do you say that?
Morgellons disease.
Morgellons disease is a byproduct of GM foods. How commonplace is this?
I've only seen intermittent cases of it on the internet. I have not actually seen a case myself. So I think probably the bigger things that are connected with it, you know, that's kind of an anomaly. That's kind of a really bizarre thing.
Yes.
But it definitely contains some GMO DNA in there, which I thought was really quite interesting. There's, you know, this is a really huge, huge subject. And I think that once you start to go down the rabbit hole of studying it, there's no lack of evidence that this is potentially harmful in the system, in the food system and in the human body and for other animals. And one of the things that I have noticed consistently with animals, because they are not people who read packages,
yeah,
and they work very instinctually, there's been consistent examples of where animals, whether they're in the wild, so like squirrels, elk, deer, raccoons, and mice, or whether even they're animals that have been farmed, there's this consistent thing that happens is when they're given a choice between conventional feed or genetically modified feed, they choose the conventional, and only when the genetically the conventional feed is run out, they will actually consider eating the genetically modified feed. There's many examples. I mean, I've had examples of my own animals where when I was living in Australia, I have two Burmese cats, and they would never eat the salmon there, and all the salmon was farmed. And when I came to Canada, my mother said, "Why don't you give them, you know, the scraps from the salmon?" And I said, "They won't eat salmon," even though my cat at the time was just kind of going wild. So I gave him some of the wild salmon, and he ate it all up. So he will eat wild salmon, but he won't eat farm salmon. You know, and I just find it consistently interesting. There's an example in the Copenhagen Zoo of chimpanzees that were given a choice between conventional bananas and organic bananas. And when the zookeeper first gave the bananas to the chimpanzees that were conventional, they would peel them and eat them. And one day he got the shipment of organic bananas in, and they ate the bananas whole.
Oh.
So he then decided that he would actually give them a choice between the organic and conventional. They went straight to the organic bananas, ate them whole, and once they were done, they then went and peeled the conventional bananas and ate them.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating. So animals have this intuition that they operate on. Obviously, they can't read packages. They don't know nutritional labels, but they have their instincts are very, very highly tuned. Humans still have this. We are mammals. We still have this, but we've been desensitized, and in our culture, we've actually almost been made to feel stupid if we trust our instincts over scientific data. And what I learned in my many years of study, when I started to study at Deakin University in health and behavioral sciences and then through Nutrition Australia, is I learned that science can be manipulated, and you can find a scientific study to support any kind of viewpoint of how you want to eat. And it's because when you drill down to the minutiae of detail, the micro detail, you can actually take things out of context. And just like a lawyer on a cross-examination of a witness can make a lie look like the truth or a truth look like a lie, once you actually just scan out and you see things on a macro context, on bringing everything into the picture, things are much less likely for us to be manipulated. And that's why I've actually created the philosophies that I teach, like nature's principle, like the consumption concept, like the lethal recipe, is because they bring things out into a broader context and help us understand things on a macro level, to understand how nature works on a macro level, how things have actually worked naturally for thousands of years rather than what's happened primarily in the last 100 to 200 years, is where we've really felt that we can circumvent and reinvent and be smarter than nature. And what I've observed is that we either create one or many problems each time we do this.
So the tools you have are really helping us retrain our instinct to know what is good for us and what's not. How else would you encourage Americans or Canadians or other people to gain that instinct back? Is it basically how they feel? Is it just through education? Or what would be some other tools you could offer to help us understand how to instinctively eat?
Yes, well, so the first tool that I talk to people about is the lethal recipe, and I talk about how things are actually made. There's a common denominator between how we've actually processed things, which are very similar to how we actually take coca leaves and turn them into cocaine, or opium sap and turn it into heroin. In their natural state, opium sap and coca leaves are, they're not highly addictive, and they're not toxic to the body, and you would never eat that much of it in nature. Once we actually go through several processes of turning them into drugs by using extreme heat, removing macro and micronutrients, vitamins, minerals, and phytochemicals, and mixing in toxic chemicals to create these clear white substances, they become highly toxic and addictive to the human body. And if you look at things like refined sugars, oils, salts, grains, chemicals, and there are other foods in our supermarket, you know, like the dairy, the soy, that have been manipulated in this way, and then adding genetic mutations or, you know, modifications on top of that, they really create this toxic addictive cycle within the body. So the lethal recipe is basically one of the things I encourage people to avoid, anything that has foods that are processed in this way, or certainly try to find their natural variations of them. So refined sugar can be replaced with coconut palm sugar that's just simply dehydrated, or rapadura sucanat. They're still sugars. They're not something we're meant to eat a large amount of, but they still have macro and micronutrients in it, so sometimes fiber, you know, vitamins and minerals, and the body can actually absorb it much more easily than the refined sugar. With oils, to look at more natural oils, so cold pressed oils, and I tend to go towards more oils that can be expressed by hand, because what we're finding is the seed and some nut oils have to be extracted using the expeller, not expeller process, the solvent extraction, which uses heptane and hexane to remove the seed from the nut cake, and then it can go up to 12 different processes using all kinds of chemicals like sodium hydroxide and phosphoric acid, highly corrosive substances, and synthetic antioxidants. So avoiding the lethal recipe is the number one tool. And then the second tool, the antidote to that, is to actually look at nature's principle, which is nature tells us what to eat and the quantities to eat it, and by how easily it's obtained in nature and when it's obtained in nature. So that which is most abundant, we're meant to have most of in nature. The harder it is to obtain in nature, we're meant to have less of it. And nature gives us stronger physiological compulsions and desires to work hard for those foods. And even though they're higher in energy, we actually work off the equivalent or more of the energy that's in those foods. So there's this kind of normalizing thing that happens around nature. And that's why, you know, natural cultures, people who eat and source their own food, aren't obese. And the third group is that if you cannot get it in nature, not only do you not need it, it's harmful to your body and the environment. And what we're seeing in North American supermarkets, and it's filtering out into, you know, Australia and the UK and other parts of the world, and any culture that does import this lethal recipe, what we're seeing is that most of our diet's actually coming from what you cannot obtain in nature, and it being most likely harmful to the body and the environment. So the antidote to the lethal recipe and using nature's principle is combined with what I call the consumption concept. And it's really a mind shift for us to actually retrain our brains to how did we eat in a natural environment. And most people think, okay, well, I'll go back to the farm. Well, the farm is actually not a natural environment, even good organic farms. They are constructs of humans that allowed us to get, you know, a lot of food where we didn't have to hunt and gather and move out over a long, you know, or broad area. We can actually get it all in one place. Now, modern farms are definitely unnatural. But what we, if we actually kind of look in a, the consumption concept talks about, I say that if you had to source your own food in nature, in a natural environment, not even a farm, you would eat completely different to how you eat today. And I'm talking even about, you know, the raw food vegans, you know, and the super kind of natural healthy eaters, is that they would be eating completely different, because they certainly wouldn't be getting, you know, 50 different superfoods from around the world that create, again, an environmental problem for importing these things all over the place. And they can actually create confusion in the body, because literally if you have 50 different superfoods that you're putting into a smoothie or a shake, they're literally tens of thousands of ingredients that are going into your body, phytochemicals, nutrients, and things like that, that flood the body and can actually confuse it. So a simple example I show people is that in nature tells us to eat more vegetables than fruits by the fact that there are more species of vegetables. They're more available year-round than fruit. If you plant a seed for a vegetable, you can have it within a few months. You can actually eat it. Whereas if you plant a fruit seed, it usually takes years for the actual tree to grow. And even then when it does grow, you have to climb a tree to get it. But even if it's in a berry form, you don't just eat it when it's fresh and young. You eat it after it's grown to maturity and then ripened, whereas vegetables, they're best when they're fresh and young. And in that ripening process is where most of the nutrients are actually infused into the plant. So it's nature's way of saying eat lots of these vegetables while you're waiting, you know, and then you get this reward of this fruit that's sweet and delicious and has all these wonderful flavors and nutrients in it. You know, most of the fruit that we're eating nowadays is not grown naturally. You know, sometimes even if it's organically grown, it's not grown naturally. And so it really impresses upon us the need to go back to actually start to develop relationships with farmers. And I'm a big advocate and fan of farmers markets. So, you know, whenever I can, to me it becomes the highlight of my social week. And when I first started going, it wasn't that easy, you know, and I was a bit intimidated by shopping at farmers. It was so different to shopping at supermarkets or greengrocers as I got used to in Australia. But once I did, it literally did change my life. And when I was doing a documentary in Australia, I went to the farmers markets. And I decided to do I'm big on comparisons. And I just asked people one question. I said, how do you feel about shopping on a Saturday morning? And literally, I had a queue of people, about 30 people long, and everyone wanted to tell me. They wanted to talk to me forever and ever. And I couldn't, because I had to, you know, interview all these other people. And they were, you know, waxing lyrically about how it had also changed their life and how it was the highlight of their social week. And the food tasted so much better, and they felt better, and it was just... it felt really good to develop this relationship with the farmers, and they went on and on and on. And on the same morning, I went to a supermarket in a similar area, not far away, and I asked the same question. And it was like, if you've ever, not that you've experienced this, but the analogy of turning on a light in a room where there are termites, and they all scurry into the darker places. Well, no one wanted to be interviewed. And, you know, they weren't interested, and I saw them, you know, putting their loads of their groceries into their cars with very different ingredients than you get at the farmer's market. And, yeah, so I only interviewed one woman. She didn't want to be interviewed, but she found it hard to say no, and she said, I normally shop at the markets, but I was in a hurry because it's my grandson's birthday. So we do have so much more power. We have more intelligence and wisdom and intuition, and what happens is I think we've been highly distracted in our society with entertainment, with myriad different forms of electronic devices that actually take our attention away from being present. And actually, even when we do get to a meal, to sharing those social connections, which can be as powerful, if not more, than the food we're eating. So when we actually take our power back and we start to go back, returning to eating real food, we return to shopping in a much more natural way, we're sourcing our food in a natural way, developing a relationship with the farmer, developing those beautiful social connections that happen over a meal, it becomes life transformative, and it becomes empowering, and it becomes something that a French proverb that I adore says, where love sets the table, food tastes its best. And to me, when we start to source our food this way, we show love for our bodies, we show love for ourselves, we show love for the people who are actually growing this food, because if they're exposed to BT technology, which is toxic, just inhaling the pollen from the genetically modified technology can be toxic to the human body. And it's certainly not showing a love for future generations. When we eat organically, when we take care of the soil and even biodynamically, which is even better than organic, we're showing loves for ourselves, our bodies, and the environment.
You are wealth and rich knowledge about all this. I was going to ask you about what's the example of eating more of what's in nature versus what's what's readily available versus what you have to work for. And I'd never heard that vegetable and fruit analogy before.
And I've not either until I came up with it.
Yeah. I mean, we're always told to eat more fruits, I mean, more vegetables, but why? And here's just one supporting argument for that.
Yeah.
That's great. I think I'll ask you just one more question. When someone starts looking into this topic and they read all about Monsanto, about these biotech companies, the clean 15 list of foods you can eat that don't have to be organic versus the dirty dozen, what is one thing you recommend for a person to do who wants to start change and start eating healthy?
It's a one thing with a two-parter, if I can do that. The first thing is to just designate some quiet time so that you're not actually going into overwhelm. And to really, John Wooden, who's a coach, said, do not allow what you cannot do to interfere with what you can do. And so I just keep on focusing on what I can do. Even if it was, proven, that the odds were against me, I would keep doing what I can do because it makes me feel better.
Mm-hmm.
The part of that is when you get quiet and you start to really focus on what you can do, solutions come up for you. You know, you find ways that where you thought it was impossible, you'll actually find a way to source or get good food or find the time to create good food. And when you actually, put the resources towards that, it pays back. It pays back, People will spend hundreds of dollars on medication but won't spend, an extra $2 a pound for organic broccoli.
Mm-hmm.
We need to actually get quiet so we can actually hear the inner workings, the wisdom that's intuitive to every one of us on the planet.
Thank you so much, Sherry. This has been a very insightful time with you, and I'm hoping people will listen to this and glean one or two amazing things from what you said, and that I agree with what you cannot do will keep you from what you can do. So focus on what you can do. What are the options and the changes? That one thing, buying organic broccoli, starting to shop at a farmer's market can be so transformational.
They will, I promise.
Yes. Then they'll start feeling better and their diseases will go away.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, any last parting word?
I think the sum of it is I have little illustrations that accompany all my work in the book that I've written. And the one that I use for my programs that is an anchor for me, it has a picture of a man with a cape on. And he's a bit of a funky looking dude. And the words around it say, become your own hero. So do the thing that you fear you cannot do, but you know in your heart you must do. The thing that you so admire in others, but in your own unique and loving way. And I think when you start to approach food to become your own food hero, your own health hero, that it comes from a much stronger, healthier place, and it's much more lasting and sustainable.
A good word to end on. Become your food hero. Thank you so much, Sherry.
Thank you, Cheryl.